From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Among the things that House Democrats are vowing to do with their new political power is to roll back the increasing restrictions on abortion access under President Donald Trump. In particular, they want to reverse the ban on federal funding for organizations that offer abortion services. But already there is a bleak landscape across the U.S. when it comes to abortion access. Anti-choice activists have had great success in restricting a woman's right to abortion at the state level, with new bills being proposed all the time. They have their eye on reversing the popular and critically important Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade. What would happen if abortion became illegal all across the U.S.? My guest Robin Marty asks and answers that question in her new book, Handbook for a Post-Roe America. It's a guidebook of sorts for women who might see an end to abortion rights in their lifetime, but also for those who currently live in states where abortion access has been effectively decimated. Robin Marty is an activist and writer. Her earlier book was called Crow After Roe, which will be re-released later this year. She joins me to discuss her latest book, Handbook for a Post-Roe America. Welcome to the program, Robin.
Thanks so much, Sonali.
Thanks for joining us. So just on the day you and I are speaking, there is a bill being proposed in the state of Florida that would ban abortions as soon as a fetal heartbeat is first detected, which is basically when a woman finds out often that she is pregnant. And we're seeing things like this in states like Ohio, whether or not that bill will go anywhere. We already have a current system, don't we, where if you live in a state where abortion clinics have essentially been defunded and pushed into fewer and fewer, more and more remote locations, that access to an abortion is effectively out of reach for women.
Right. And the Florida case in particular is a really alarming one because this is the first time that we've seen what they call a heartbeat ban be introduced in a state and probably pass in a state where Florida actually offers most of the abortion access for the Southeast. In the Southeast, we see a lot of states that have one, maybe two, sometimes as many as three abortion clinics, and a lot of patients are already going over to Florida in order to get their abortion care because there are so many clinics there. If Florida actually manages to pass a heartbeat ban and it stops allowing abortion after 6 weeks, and the state actually upholds it and the courts decide that they're not going to turn it down, then that could basically mean the end of abortion access for a lot of people all throughout the Southeast.
So currently, there are, and you point out in your book, there are these abortion deserts, if you will, in the entire country. It sort of reminds me of the language that food activists have used to talk about food deserts, where access to healthy, fresh food is so limited. So there are many, many parts of the United States today where there is just this huge swath of land between you and the nearest abortion clinic, right?
True. Yeah. And one of the things that's alarming about it is we often go through and we look at, okay, here are the states that are going to overturn Roe. If Roe is overturned, that they're going to make abortion illegal. But what we don't do in these abortion deserts, as you put them, is look at the states that say that they will keep abortion intact and legal. And a lot of them, although they do have multiple clinics and will have abortion available, those clinics are only in very limited number of cities. So for instance, I live out in Minnesota. Minnesota has already guaranteed in the state constitution a right to an abortion. So Minnesota should keep abortion legal. However, we only have two cities in the state that actually offer care.
So we also have this political landscape where there have been concerted efforts to undo Roe versus Wade. It's been the sort of fantasy of anti-abortion activists since Roe v. Wade was decided to eventually tilt the direction of the entire Supreme Court and have a redo and overturn this popular decision. Every Supreme Court appointment brings us, it seems, closer to that dire future. There's been now talk of Ruth Bader Ginsburg potentially retiring. She has had cancer multiple times. And the Republicans are openly talking about creating a shortlist of people to replace her. How much of Supreme Court nominee decisions are based on overturning Roe v. Wade?
At this point, everything that they are doing when it comes with coming up with a short list for the Supreme Court on the right does involve overturning Roe v. Wade. When President Trump said that he was going to be running for office in the beginning and it was clear that he was going to get the nomination, the reason that the anti-abortion and the far-right activists and especially the evangelical activists came to him and decided that they were okay with voting for him was this idea that he would, at the very least, go and put in a Supreme Court that would take away abortion rights, that would probably end any protection for GLBT people, that would basically uphold the entirety of their Christian views and make sure that they can practice religion in whatever sort of discriminatory way they want to do. So that has been the promise that he made to them. And that honestly has been the one public policy that he has managed to do the entire time. They're perfectly happy with him, and they are more than willing to keep doing what they need to do in order to make sure that he gets reelected.
So the threat to Roe versus Wade is very, very real. Hence your book, Handbook for a Post-Roe America.
It's very real, but also it needs to be understood that for many of the communities already, there isn't abortion that's accessible already. Roe was never realized for them. For people of color, for people in rural and minority communities, it's already been impossible to get an abortion because the cost is too much. There's too many different barriers that they have to get through when it comes to trying to get through 72-hour waiting periods or travel as far as they need to go in order to go and get to a clinic, all of these things, Roe isn't there for them. Abortion access isn't there for them. And when we look at what the Supreme Court could do across the country, there's a very strong possibility that the courts could decide to let this get even worse without actually overturning Roe, in which case all they have to do is either decide that we are going to now allow heartbeat bans, say that heartbeat is a point of viability rather than the standard viability when a fetus can survive on its own, which is usually around 22 weeks, or they could just choose not to take up any challenges that happen at the states and let the states go ahead and act whatever rules they want to, as long as they say that abortion isn't technically illegal.
So your book is, it seems, twofold. One, it's literally a sort of a solutions handbook for women who live in parts of the country that have very little access to abortion. And then it's also sort of an organizing handbook for those who want to be politically active and try to preserve what little we seem to have left. Let's talk about the first part of it. There was a time in America where the clothes hanger became a very grim symbol for why abortion access was necessary. And that was because women were performing their own at-home abortions in unsafe ways, and many of them dying because they were desperate for access to this reproductive care. But we live in the age of the internet these days. What are ways in which today a woman living in an abortion desert might actually be able to take her fate in her own hand, exercise her autonomy if she has an unintended pregnancy?
One of the things, ways in which we're really lucky at this moment is the fact that because we do have a lot of knowledge about self-managed abortion care, primarily through using RU486 or using Cytotec alone, we're in a much better space because we have the ability that people can manage their own care at home, and it's extraordinarily safe. The only
Can you explain those terms you just threw out?
Sure. Self-managed care. So the idea that a person would, say, purchase medication online, have it delivered to their home, and then induce their own abortion by causing a miscarriage by taking medication. There's instructions to do it up on the web. It's all based on World Health Organization protocols because other countries already do this. And so you can look it up online. A person could go and look at it's Women Help Women is the website, and it has instructions that explain how the World Health protocols work. So there's information out there. There's places online such as Plan C website that offers URLs for where people can go to get medication that they can at this point verify is the proper medication that you need. All of this can be done at home, and all of this can be done safely. The only thing that is actually dangerous about a self self-managed abortion, which is exactly the same sort of abortion that a person would do at home if they went to a clinic and picked up medication abortion, is that when people do it outside of the legal system, when they do have a complication, which is rare, they're afraid to go to hospitals. They're afraid to go and get help because they're worried that they're going to end up in jail. The only thing that makes self-managed abortion care dangerous is the idea that a person cannot go to a hospital or get follow-up care because they're afraid of being put in jail. And that's a horrifying situation. As of before, the idea of the symbol of the coat hanger being this is what happens to women if they try to induce their own abortion, now what we're going to see are women behind bars. And that's going to be the symbol of our future as more, once abortion becomes inaccessible or completely illegal, the right is going to do everything they can to make sure that any person who does their own abortion is put in jail in order to try and deter other people.
So in your book, you've gathered a lot of these online resources. Have you sort of curated what you consider to be credible information? Because, of course, the internet can be a scary place for disinformation, for misinformation as well.
Very much so. And that's one of the reasons there's more than one chapter in there about different ways that a person can do their own abortion. There's the medication, which is the safest route. There's also, before Roe had passed, there was menstrual extraction. So there's explanations in there of how to do that. There's a little bit on herbal inductions. But with all of these different ways that I explain, I also explain that, okay, these are the risks that are going to happen. These are the ones that are more likely to help you. These are the ones that are more likely to get you harmed, because if you go through the internet and just try to pull up information about how do I self-induce with parsley, what if I want to try and make a menstrual extraction kit, what if I decide that I want to try and figure out how to do my own vacuum aspiration, there's a lot of information out there that is not reliable. So this way, it's all compiled into one place where you have all the information you can get from either the creators themselves or from scientific sources, as well as all the caveats, both medical caveats and, of course, legal caveats, because we are talking about working outside of the system. So with this all in one place, that way nobody has to go and do all the searching and try and vet it all for themselves.
And of course, none of this is a substitute for just having legal access to abortion care freely all over the country. We could only wish to live in a country where when a woman has an unintended pregnancy, she can just go to her primary care provider and discuss her options at that point freely without any problems and without any scapegoating or politicizing or criminalizing. So let's talk about the political activism aspect of your book. There is still plenty of work to be done, and there's still a lot of work being done because there are many really important and really effective organizations around the country, aren't there, that have been trying to safeguard women's access to abortion?
There are. There are lots of there's lots of national organizations that are doing the work to try and safeguard access. There's also a lot of state-based organizations that are doing the same thing. Reproductive justice groups have been doing this work basically from the 80s when the first rule was passed that said that you could not use Medicaid to cover an abortion, because that primarily hit people, women of color and poor people who were unable to access abortion care because they couldn't afford it. They've already been doing the organizing on the ground ever since the 80s, 90s, and they've been doing huge amounts of work. And that's why one of the things that I have in the book is a resource guide in the back that's divided up by each state. So there's national organizations in there, but if you turn to whatever state you live in, you can find a listing of first all of the abortion clinics in your state, and then all of the groups that a person can get individually involved with that is local to them, so that if you want to join an abortion fund and help people fund abortions when they can't afford them, there's one local for you to join. If you want to be a person who will drive somebody to a clinic because they can't get there themselves, there's a practical support group for you to join. If you want to go and lobby the legislature, here is a local political group for you to join.
So in the current work that is being done, do you feel that access to abortion rights and reproductive justice issues in general have kind of fallen by the wayside when it comes to grassroots activism? Maybe partly because we have organizations like Planned Parenthood doing political activism. see, it's not as visible as some of the other movements that are out there at the grassroots level, people fighting for rights, for their right to abortion. There's also, I sense at least, a feeling of helplessness against the very well-organized Christian right.
That I will definitely give you. Sometimes there's a definite feeling of helplessness because there is a lot of funding over there, and there's a lot of activity and a lot of different organizations over there that have people that can do a lot to both stop things legislatively and also make it look like there's a groundswell of support when there really isn't any there. I think probably the biggest problem that we have had as a movement in the abortion rights movement is the fact that from the point in which Roe was decided, basically, we thought that, okay, the courts have decided and now everything's settled and there's not really a lot to do. It took until 2010 in the Tea Party elections and when the right took over so many different state legislatures, that was the period over the next 4 years in which over 400 bills had been introduced at different state legislatures that were trying to curb the right to an abortion. We in the states did not have a network. We did not have people on the ground. Because of that, we did not have the ability to talk back and forth to each other and realize that, hey, there's a heartbeat ban over in the state. Well, that's funny. We have a heartbeat ban in our state too. What are you doing to stop it? None of that happened because we were funding everything at a national level. And what we really needed to be doing was investing in the states. It's the same thing that we really saw, in a lot of honesty, in 2016's election, because we were working so hard on this idea of nationally making sure that we got a president in the White House, that we didn't pay enough attention to certain states like Ohio, Wisconsin, Missouri. And so that's how they managed to get enough, even though there were far more people who voted for Hillary Clinton, they still had enough in the Electoral College to get Trump in. It's a very strategic, what states can you win, where can you put your resources sort of game. And it's one that, frankly, overall, we on the left had lost for a long time.
What are some of the strategies that you feel have not yet been adopted that need to be adopted in order to tackle the state-by-state actions? Are there not ways in which local groups could pool resources to make available the funding needed to provide abortion access for poor women or to protect existing clinics? As you pointed out, there are these huge places in the country where there's just nothing that women have access to.
Right. I think it's another instance of we see Planned Parenthood, we see NARAL, we see these national groups that have a lot of resources and they just need to be better invested in the states. And one of the things that I'm really happy about is the fact that the National Network of Abortion Funds is doing a wonderful job of being both a national level funding arm for making sure that people get access to care, but they're also really working on a state-by-state group network so that all of the different states can talk to each other, talk about their needs. They, I would say, probably have more, the closest thing to a 50-state network of any of our national organizations really do. And so if we can just start getting the resources to the people on the ground, and that means really get them to the people on the ground. We can't say, okay, we are a national organization and we are going to have somebody go and fly down when there's a personhood amendment and organize some people on the ground. We have to have already invested in the people in that state, given them the money, given them the resources so that they can do their own work the way that it needs to be done within their communities. And that's really been our biggest problem is this idea of gatekeeping resources in order to make sure that what scarce amount that we have is being used. Everybody's scared of losing power, and it's totally understandable, but we have a threat in the South. We have a total threat in the Midwest. We are without clinics in a lot of the mountain zone, except for Colorado. This is something that we have to take off of being power in New York, power in California, power in DC, and make sure that it's actually getting to the states individually, one by one, with the groups that are already working together, which are in many cases the reproductive justice organizations.
Is the United States going backwards when it comes globally to the landscape on reproductive justice, on reproductive rights, I should say? Ireland, staunchly Catholic country, has decriminalized abortion, made it legal nationwide, and here we are going backwards in the US.
Yeah, I think two things are going on in Ireland. One is the fact that it's a lot easier to try and change something than to try and maintain the status quo. It's the same reason why anti-abortion activists here in the US have had a lot more success etching away at abortion rights than we have had at trying to hold on to them. In Ireland, it was a lot easier to fight to try and make abortion legal because everybody had already seen how bad it was when it was illegal. So that was, I mean, that's kind of a benefit to the way that they did things, but we are definitely going backwards. But the other thing we have to understand is there is a lot of anti-abortion money, resources, etc., that went to Ireland right now to try and fight overturning their abortion ban. So it's all interconnected. A lot of the pro-life movement isn't just in the United States. It seeds itself out into other countries across the world. And so that's why we see a lot of the ebb and flow that's happening right now in all of these different countries in the world.
Robin, do you feel that a lot of the struggle around abortion access has been invisibilized? We don't really have it discussed as much in our popular culture, although that seems to be getting slightly better. Hollywood, pop culture, TV shows have often stayed away from the issue of abortion, or when they portray unintended pregnancies, have shown women agonizing over the decision over abortion and most of the time actually deciding to not choose abortions. We just don't talk about, or we don't see enough visibility of an issue that is so widespread. And actually women, so a huge number of American women have had abortions. They may not say it out loud though.
Well, and one of the things that's really frustrating, since I do cover the anti-abortion movement fairly closely, and for instance, I'm heading out to DC to go to the March for Life, which is something that I do every year.
And
When
that's
we
the
talk about,
anti-abortion,
oh, I'm
annual
sorry, yes.
anti-abortion gathering in DC.
That's the national anti-abortion gathering every year in DC. They usually have at least 100,000 people who come and march in DC for it from all across the country. A lot of things that we see happening with people who are speaking out about their abortion is that for a long time it was dominated by people who say that they regret their abortion. One of the things that's really interesting that I found in doing a bunch of research is that Silent No More campaign, which is a group from the pro-life movement where everybody discusses how much they regret their abortion, the name Silent No More actually came originally from NARAL, which is an abortion rights action group. And NARAL in the 60s and early 70s, when they were trying to get abortion to be made legal, went and had a Silent No More campaign of women who had done illegal abortions. And they wanted to make sure that people understood that they had had abortions and they needed it. So there's a lot of co-opting that happened there. And I see that today now because when people come out, like Shout Your Abortion or We Testify, which is a group from the National Network of Abortion Funds, all of these people who come out to talk about their abortion experiences, why they did it, why they don't regret it, they get pummeled online, in the news, everywhere about their experiences and how bad it is that they're quote unquote celebrating abortion. Whereas nobody does this to the people who say that they regret their abortion. And so it dominates this conversation where it looks like every person regrets their abortion. And that's one thing that they actually say on the right is this idea of, okay, these women may be saying now that I am comfortable with my choice, it gave me a better life, all of these things, but abortion regret may come 30 years down the road, 4 years down the road. So everybody regrets their abortion. You just haven't gotten there yet. And
That is
that's a
so
really hard thing for,
patronizing.
yeah, and it's a really hard thing for people to argue about. Oh, you'll get there at some point. You just don't know it yet.
Well, Robin, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck with your book, and thanks for writing it.
Oh, thank you so much. And thanks for having me on, Sonali.
My guest has been Robin Marty. She's an activist and writer. We've been discussing her new book, Handbook for a Post-Roe America. Her earlier book was called Crow After Roe, and that book is going to be re-released later this year. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.